Good morning, everybody. I noticed they're closing the doors, so it must be time to start. My name is Dave R., and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. There's a special needs section, and it looks pretty big to me, but I'm asked to remind you of that. Let's start with a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 7 years. Once again, I'm Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Negaunee, Michigan. Negaunee, Michigan is in the center of the Upper Peninsula by Lake Superior, by Marquette. So a little geography lesson for you all. I'm what's known as a Youper. I was born and raised in Negaunee, Michigan. I drank in Negaunee, Michigan. Hello, I sobered up in Ishpeming, Michigan. I'm a member of the Ishpeming Hematite Group, which is a town right next door. There were no AA meetings in Negaunee. I attended my first AA meeting in Ishpeming, Michigan on March 9th, 1975. And because of the people in that group and AA and this program, I have not found it necessary to drink since. So. The last AA meeting I attended before coming to the convention was the Ishpeming Hematite group. It is still my home group, and I've been going there for 30 years. 5 years ago, my wife and I went to Minneapolis, and they had this old-timers panel, and it seems to me, I could be wrong, but it seems to me the old-timers panel was 30 years back then in Minneapolis. And I told my wife, I said, when I get to Toronto, I'll have 30 years, you know, looking ahead one day at a time, you know what I mean? And I'll put my name in that hat, but you know, now it's 40. And by the time we get to San Antonio, who knows, it'll be 45, it might be 50. I don't know. So, but anyway. I want to tell you a few things. We have an hour and a half panel. These people are going to speak for approximately 20 minutes, and according to my instructions, I'm to talk a couple of minutes in between if that's possible. Yesterday, I had a beautiful day planned. My wife and I had breakfast. I had three panels picked out in the program book that I was going to go see. We were going to meet. She's in Al-Anon, so she was heading down towards the Westin after breakfast. We were going to meet at 5 o'clock by the AA archives display in the hospitality room, then have dinner and go to the opening ceremonies at the Sky Dome. The first panel I was going to attend was at 9:30 a.m. It was called Sober While, Now What? All right, something like that at 9:30. I got there about 2 minutes before the panel was to begin. However, there was guards at the door, and I wasn't allowed in. Now, some of you may have had that experience. Now, so my very first day at the convention, full day at the convention, even with 30 years of sobriety, I was kind of ticked off. Right. I mean, this happened to me a couple of times in Minneapolis. See? And so I was kind of really, I mean, there's other panels in there, although there's a big gap between 9:30 and whatever. So I went down to the hospitality room and got a cup of coffee, and I was wondering what I was going to do. And I noticed a few things that I will share with you as the program continues that relate to me and came to believe that I was thinking about. The very first one, I'll tell you one right now. Thousands of people are going this way and that way. Some are going down the escalator, and some are coming up the escalator. And we're all going like a mass confusion, you know, and this is a program of unity. And I'm looking at this and I'm wondering, all this chaos, it seems so chaotic, but yet people that I didn't even know would say, hi, Dave. Hi, Dave. People that saw each other, hadn't seen each other for a while, were shaking hands, were talking. It was and I begin to watch this and witness this, and it dawned on me that we are all heading, irregardless where we're physically heading, we are all heading in the same direction. It's a spiritual direction, the fellowship of the Spirit. Just going to different panels, that's all. All right, so. Speaking of panels, our first speaker today is going to be Joseph G. from California. Let's welcome Joe.
Good morning. My name is Joe, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May the 21st, 1977. My home group is the Imperial Men's, San Diego, California. We meet Sunday at 10 a.m. You guys are welcome anytime you get in town. Now, they tell me that this panel is on Came to Believe. Now, I'm here to tell you that I had trouble with this when I came in this program. All right, I'm a psychiatric nurse. I've worked in mental hospitals all my life, and I felt I certainly wasn't crazy when I came in this program. I drank a little bit too much, but I was not crazy. And after I was around for a while, I got to step two, and it says in there, you know, that sanity is defined as soundness of mind. And it goes on to say that any alcoholic looking back on the wreckage of his past, the destruction that he caused to the furniture or to his moral fiber, cannot claim soundness of mind. So I had to take a look at that. And so I went into my story, which is, I was a daily drinker when I came in this program. I better look at my watch because Dave told me that he will tug on me when I go too long. But I was a daily drinker. If I was awake, I was drinking. It was simple as that. I didn't need a bad day, a good day, a rainy day. All that I had to do was open my eyes, and I was drinking. You know, I worked for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and it was easy to drink at work because I was in charge of my own ward. So I looked at some of the things that I did when I was in step two, and you know, like... I wrecked my wife's car twice, totaling it the second time. Ended up in the hospital with a crushed jaw, and the guy that I hit had a broken leg. I was stopped on the Schuylkill Expressway. Anybody from Philadelphia in the group knows where we're talking about. It's Schuylkill Expressway. I was going east in the westbound lanes, and the Pennsylvania State Police stopped me, asked me where I was going. I said I was going to Pottstown. And he looked at me kind of funny. He said, "Do you know where you're at?" And I said, "No." And so the lady that was with me, he asked her if she had a driver's license. He took me out of the car and put me in there, and I got me headed in the right direction. I once ripped the antenna off my ex-wife's car, and it is an ex-wife. And I did like $400 or $500 damage to the car because she wouldn't give me the keys because I was drunk. And all my in-laws were, it's a three-story house, all my in-laws were in the windows watching me as I ripped this antenna off, I broke the windshield, I kicked the doors in. You know, my father-in-law, who was a very gentle man, told me about a week or two later, he said, "We really enjoy you coming over to visit." He said, "But if you're going to behave like that, we'd sooner you not come." I worked in a state hospital at that time outside of Philadelphia town called Norristown, and one night we had a building that had 218 patients in it, and I got flaming drunk one night, and I took over 100 of them to the movie on the grounds by myself. They covered for me by sitting me between two of the biggest guys in the group so that I wouldn't fall over and my supervisor wouldn't know. And it was after that I had my first intervention. About two or three days later, about five of them took me into a side room, and they told me they were concerned about how much I was drinking. Now, I was supposed to be taking care of them, you know. So, but that didn't stop me. That didn't stop me. I still kept drinking. And, you know, for those of you, I hear people frequently, they insult me sometimes in this program because people frequently say, "Well, I had my bottom when I was drinking Thunderbird." Thunderbird was my drink of choice. And people didn't like going places with me because they said it was embarrassing to go into a nice club in Philly and I go in there and order a glass of Thunderbird. You know, but anyway, you know, that's what I drank. I hear people talk about they would do different things to stop drinking. I did different things to stay in the Philadelphia area. So if I drank whiskey or vodka, whatever, I would generally stay right in the Philadelphia area. I might, you know, branch out to Westchester, places like that. But if I drank Thunderbird, it was different. I would go by the Dirty Bar, which is in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. I'd go by the Dirty Bar, and I would say, I'm going to have one. And I'd go in the Dirty Bar, and I'd have one, and I would wake up on Bourbon Street in New Orleans. You know? And this happened to me frequently. I'd wake up in Chicago. I'd wake up in New York. I'd wake up in Atlantic City. This is when I drank Thunderbird, you know. And then I'd have to call the front desk to find out where I was at. And it wasn't, and it was really embarrassing to say, you know, where is this, you know? And then it wasn't until I got to the program that a guy told me how I could have not been so embarrassed. He said, you didn't have to do that. And I said, well, what should I have done? He said, well, you just go ahead and buy a newspaper, you know? So that's how I drank, you know, and that, you know, and I had to take a look at all these things that I did, but I think the biggest insanity of all, for me was constantly picking up that first drink expecting something different to happen, and it just never did. It never did. You know, and I kept drinking like that. I didn't do anything to stop drinking. I did a few things to keep drinking. You know, I remember my wife said she was going to leave me if I didn't stop drinking. So I had a minister come over, and we had a prayer circle in my front room. That was so I could keep drinking. They thought it was so I could stop drinking. That was just to get her off my back. You know, people wouldn't go places with me. Now, I got some of my friends out there now. They go places with me, but they pick on me. You know, I think that's because I'm older than them. Anyway, I came to one morning, and looking back on it, I think it was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I crawled over, and I called AA, and I said, I can't stop drinking. So they told me to come down to a place called the Paoli Addiction Center, and that they would help me. They said, don't drink, come straight down. Well, there was no way I could drive down there and not drink. So I stopped on Route 30, and I got myself a double shot of vodka, and I had a Smith's Draft. And that was the first time in my life I was ever honest about my drinking. When I got down there, they said, did you drink anything on the way down? And I said, yeah. You know, because see, to me, you know, I hear guys say, well, I tell my wife I had a couple. I never had any. My wife say, you've been drinking? I say, nope. You know, it's just easier to do it that way. To me, to admit part of it was to admit it all. You know, and to me, lying was an art. You had to get good eye contact, you know, right? You know, and then tell yourself that lie till you believed it so you could get indignant when they didn't believe it, you know? That's what I would do. And anyway, so I told them I had been drinking. They said, well, we've got two places you can go. You can either go to Chit Chat Farms in Reading, Pennsylvania, or you can go to Living Green in Philadelphia in Northeast Philly. Well, I didn't like the name Chit Chat Farms. That didn't even sound good to me. So I went to Living Green. And it was a 28-day program. I understand now it's all outpatient. But I went to Living Green. I was there 28 days. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has a good policy on alcoholism and drug addiction, you know. And I went there, and the first thing I noticed was that people seemed to be happy, you know. And I wondered, is this what I've been looking for? Because when I used to drive around at 3 o'clock in the morning looking for it, you know, the bars are closed, people don't want you at your house because you haven't bathed in a week, you know. And it was there I found out that I was an alcoholic. You know, and they told me things like, you don't have to drink anymore, even if you want to. That if you don't drink, one day at a time, your life would get better. They told me to keep coming back, and I hated that. I hated it when they told me to keep coming back. And when I got out, I had to go to meetings. And they said, you go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. And I want to go to meetings today, you know, but I got a sponsor. They told me, you know, all these suggestions. I think somebody talked about it last night. I think the lady said, when they said suggestions, they're telling you what to do. You know, and I got a sponsor. I did all the things that they suggested, and then I moved out to Arizona because I was trying to save my marriage, you know. But, you know, wherever you go, there you are, you know. So I ended up getting divorced, and I stayed out there. Now, I want to say this because there's a couple of my sponsees in the group here and everything, so, and I know they're going to say something to me afterwards. Now, I've been married and divorced 4 times, 3 times in the program, so I can't tell you nothing about relationships. I can tell you how I stay sober, but I can't tell you nothing about relationships, you know. And I think they sent them out here with me to make sure I come back single, you know. But anyway, you know, I did all the things that were suggested, you know, and I really, you know, like it says in chapter 3, we must fully concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholic. That is the first step in recovery. I firmly believe that. And I know that I'm an alcoholic. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't have any problem with being powerless over alcohol. So that's not an issue anymore. Life is my issue. And I learned in here how to be a good father, how to be a good employee, a reasonable ex-husband, you know. I learned how to do all those things in this program. You know, my kids want to be around me now. I have my family back, and that's the most precious thing to me, that I do things with my children now. I fly back east every year. We go to Wildwood, New Jersey, and they hate it, but they go to please me. You know, my daughter called me this morning before I came down, and she told me, good luck. You know, and my life has just gotten so much better. You know, and I hear people talk about problems and things like that. And to me, there's no problem I have that a drink won't make worse. You know, I go to meetings. People say, well, you've been around a while. You still go to those meetings? I go, yeah. Well, why do you go to those meetings? We have a guy, Roland K., in my home group that says, people that don't go to meetings aren't around to see what happens to people that don't go to meetings. You know, and I believe that. I'm not going to stand here and say that you have to go to meetings to stay sober. I'm quite sure there are people that don't go to meetings to stay sober. I have not met any. You know, I've not met them in my 20 years in this program. So I keep going to meetings, and you know, they'll say, well, why do you go? I say, I go for that time when that thought to drink pops into my head, because that's what I do. I drink, you know, to protect me from this. Because this one, it sees one of them blue bottles in a travel magazine, I'll say, well, I never drank out of a bottle like that. Or when I go to a restaurant, you know, for a nice romantic dinner, you know, and I see them, I don't even know what you call that thing, that silver thing that they bring the bottle in at the table, you know. And I say, well, I never did that. But if I had a drink out of that thing, I wouldn't have dinner. Probably wouldn't end up with the woman I was with at the end of the night. So that's why I go to meetings. I go to meetings, and my first sponsor used to say, and I used to hate it when he said, I come here to keep my memory green. And I used to hate it when Joe would say that, you know. But that's why I come here. This is the first time in my life I've ever taken any direction from anybody. And I used to think saying things like this was corny, but I'm going to say it because it's what I feel. When I head to my meeting and I see the guy standing out in front of that meeting, everything is okay. No matter what's going on in my life, everything is okay. You know, there's a feeling I get, and you know, here, I mean, God's tenfold, you know. My life has gotten so much better since I came in this program. They told me to keep coming back and to get better, and I used to hate that when they told me that, but it's true, you know. It's true. So I definitely was insane, still am at times. I can still come up with a really brilliant solution to my problems, even with my time in the program. And that's why I tell people, get a good support group. And that's a support group that when you're telling them that solution, and you get the look on their face as you're telling them, and you hear what you're saying, you know that you've gone crazy again, you know? So I tell newcomers, you get a support group that will pull your chain. And if you have a support group that agrees with everything you say, get a different support group. You know? So I keep coming back, and it has kept, it keeps getting better, you know. And I have a God in my life today. You know, God didn't desert me. I deserted God. It was so much easier to do the things I was doing, you know, when I turned my back on God. But if I wonder whether there is a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, how could I sat in that stadium last night and not know that? You know, I mean, sitting in that stadium last night, I don't know about you guys, but there was God in that stadium last night. There was God in that stadium last night. And I thank God for AA. I thank AA for getting me back to my God. And I thank all you folks for helping keep me sober. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. Another thing that happened to me when I couldn't get to that first panel yesterday, and I had this cup of coffee in my hand, and I noticed there was row upon row of bulletin boards. Now, I didn't notice that in Minneapolis, and maybe it was there. With alphabetical, where you leave little sticky notes or notes for people, you know, and I said to myself, you know, you think anybody would leave a note for me? I mean, my wife is already here, you know, and so I went and started to look in the arts, and there's about four panels of arts. Dave R. Karen says hi. Now, I'm the chairperson of this panel, and our next speaker is Karen. So I said, I wonder. That's Karen, okay? So I went over to the K's, and I wrote a note that says, to Karen K., Michigan, from Dave R., hi back. See you in the morning. Okay. Later in the afternoon, when my wife and I met by the archives, getting ready to go to dinner, we went over to the thing, and I told her about this, and so we went over to the K's to see if anything had happened with my note. Now, by the way, I took the Dave R. from Karen note down. Okay. So I went over to it, and lo and behold, on the bottom of this note, it says, yes, see you there, Karen. Okay. She answered. Okay. So I just met her this morning, and she answered a note, but she told me that she didn't write the first note. So if there's a Dave R. and a Karen in this audience, I apologize that you two never got together last night. Anyway, maybe it's a God thing. Right? So, anyway, with that, I want to introduce Karen from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hello, everyone. My name is Karen Kay, and I do hail from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Yay! My sobriety date is January 4th, 1990. By the way, I want to show you where Kalamazoo is. I'm in the Lower Peninsula, and this is Michigan of the Lower Peninsula, and Kalamazoo is right here. And this is one of the ways you know you're from Michigan. If you know you're from Michigan, you show people where you live by holding your hand up. This is only my second international convention. My first one was Minneapolis. Yeah. I was, for many, many years, extremely phobic, and I couldn't fly. I couldn't drive sober. I couldn't do much of anything sober. I couldn't leave my house for other than very short distances. And no way in hell I'd have been done doing anything like this sober. So when I was able to go, thank you. When I was able to go to that first international convention in Minneapolis sober, it was just the most thrilling thing for me to be at something like that. And I especially remember being in the big meetings and being able to be in a stadium like that and go up high. Because we had a bunch of people from Kalamazoo that all went in together, and someone wanted to sit up real high. So we were all way up there. And I've got pictures of me up there that I brought back to show some of my friends from a phobia support group that I really did it. Well, I was equally thrilled. As soon as we left there, it's like we knew we were coming to Toronto. My husband also was in the program, and he's got 22 years. So It's a different a topic, but sometime I'll have to tell you about the 7 years in between the time he got sober and I got sober. Real interesting 7 years. But when I got the letter in the mail a few months ago saying that I had somehow been chosen, one of many people who had asked to be on a panel, and my name had gotten pulled out of a hat or something, and that I was going to be on this panel, oh my God, I mean, not only was I going to be in Toronto, but I was going to be on a panel. I was going to be a little tiny part of this convention, and that was the most thrilling thing. Until I read a little farther down in the letter, and it said the topic came to believe. I'm not real big on the God stuff. So I thought, they must have made a mistake. They put me on the wrong panel. And I was thinking, maybe I should give them a call, and maybe I could get them to give them some suggestions of where I would fit in a little better. One panel that came in mind was how to survive menopause and stay sober. Or if that one didn't work, you know when we go through that big hall and they have all those slogans? My very favorite AA slogan didn't happen to be in that hall, but that my favorite slogan would have made a good panel, and that's early sobriety sucks. However, after I thought about it for a little while, I thought maybe it's a good idea for me to be on this panel, and maybe this is where I'm supposed to be. Maybe I could give a little bit of a different viewpoint on the topic of came to believe, because I am an agnostic. I do have a different concept of spirituality and higher powers than a lot of people in the program. And I thought, maybe this is where I should be today. When I was real new in the program, I used to go to a meeting on Sunday mornings. And by the way, I still go to that same Sunday morning meeting. It's still going strong. It's in the basement of the Alano Club in Kalamazoo, 11 a.m. Sunday mornings. If anyone's ever visiting, it's a great meeting. The upstairs is full of big meetings, but we have this one little one stuck down in the basement. It's called the Peach Room meeting because the walls used to be painted peach, but they aren't anymore. But somebody thought that was peat. And so I said, who's Pete? What's this Pete's room thing? But it's the Peach Room. There was this elderly lady in the program when I was new, and her name was Edith. And she was sort of the grand old dame of AA in Kalamazoo. And I still can remember sitting in that room one day when the topic had to do with spirituality. And I can still remember Edith saying, in the way that only Edith could, the only thing you have to know about God is that you're not it. And that has stuck with me. That works for me. At the same time when I was new, I was also seeing a psychologist, and my shrink had on her wall a sign, and the sign said, relax and resign as general manager of the universe. That also works for me. What works for me is a higher power, is realizing that it's got to be a power outside myself, that it's not all about me. I have sponsees who are very devout. I have one that's a Catholic who happens to be here today, which is really cool. First time I've met him, he came from California. I have other sponsees that are religious also. And I tell them, use your higher power. Whatever your religion is, whatever your beliefs are, use it. I don't think the important thing is what we believe. I think the important thing is that we believe something, and whatever it is, that we use it, and how we use it is what I think is what counts. You know, you guys, I don't know what's out there. I really don't. I only know is that what's out there is working today in this program. For me, probably my higher power is the power of AA. And as Joe mentioned, how could you have been in that room last night? How many people here were there last night at the big meeting? Did you all feel the energy? The energy in that room? And I remember that from Minneapolis, but it just, I still get goosebumps thinking about last night and that we're going to be doing that again tonight. There is definitely a power greater than ourselves in this program, and that was there last night. I do go to several different meetings around Kalamazoo, and one I do is a big book meeting that meets every Tuesday at noon. And in addition to reading the first 164 pages, we also go through the stories. And after I got my letter in the mail, I also was sitting in, not long after that, at this big book meeting, and there was a story that really, I really listened to, and it really talked to me about this topic. The story is, in the third edition, was called The Vicious Cycle, but in the fourth edition, I think they've changed the name to Our Southern Friend. But this guy was one of the first people that wrote in the big book, and he was the guy who suggested that that we put in the term God should be qualified in the term. Let me just read what he said. It says, "They fought shy of including my story in the book, so my only contribution to their literary efforts was my firm conviction, being still a theological rebel, that the word God should be qualified with the phrase, as we understood him. For that was the only way I could accept spirituality." And I'm really glad they included his story and that they included those words. Another story that really just read last week was The Man Who Mastered Fear. And, boy, that guy was telling my story as far as the mastering fear. I haven't totally mastered it yet. I'm still nervous up here. But, you know, it's a progress. It's progress, not perfection. But he not only talked about that, about the mastering of the fear, but his spiritual beliefs were also very, very similar to mine when I read that story and heard that story last week. And I just thought, I'm really glad these people's stories are in the big book, because there are a lot of agnostics in the program. And we are alive, and we are doing well, and we are staying sober. And that's what counts. The last part of the step that starts with Came to Believe says the part about restoring us to sanity. Now, you guys, I don't usually share my age in a room full of strangers like this, although in this case, you aren't all strangers. You're all either friends or friends that I haven't met yet. But I still don't normally share my age, but I'm going to do it today and for a special reason. I had a birthday last week, last month I turned 58 years old. My father died when he was 59. He was a practicing alcoholic. He did not die of his alcoholism. He died from a different addiction, but he died. The alcohol would have gotten him if he hadn't died then. He was on his way. I worked for the state of Michigan for 31 years, and I retired 3 years ago. And I had several friends that were good drinking buddies. And one of my good friends from work died last fall from cirrhosis. She was 57, I think, 57, maybe 58. She never found this program. Another guy that I drank with at work, he retired the same time I did. He's been, ever since the day he retired, he's been in and out of hospitals. He just got out of jail after he got three drunk drivings that he got caught finally. He did this a lot, but he got caught finally three times in 6 weeks. It's catching up with him. His health is bad, and I don't know whether he's going to make it. I pray for him all the time. I hope he does. But he's 58. When I said my dad died, actually, I was adopted at birth. I was born in Seattle, and my parents who adopted me moved to Michigan when I was a baby. So I have never found out anything about my birth family until I just finally decided in the last year that maybe I was long past due that I tried to research my roots. So I started this journey of finding out something about my birth family. I found out about a month ago that my birth mother died of cancer when she was 58. Now, I'm a cancer survivor, so that tells me, you know, it's a lot. And thank you. But I didn't know whether I was going to be able to find out anything about my birth father or not. And then a week ago, the lady in Seattle who was helping me with my adoption search called me a week ago today. And we were just getting ready to leave because we came early. We came last Sunday. So last Saturday night I was packing. And I got a call, and she told me that she had located a death certificate for my birth father. He died from a skull fracture as a result of a fall. He was unemployed. The death certificate also showed that he suffered from hardening of the arteries and cirrhosis of the liver. I think there's a good chance my birth father was an alcoholic. And when he died, he was 58 years old. All these people died too young. They died due to this insanity. And, you know, I think that at least a little tiny bit of this insanity can stop with me. And that as long as I remember everything that I have come to believe about my higher power, and I use it, then maybe I have a fighting chance not to give in to this insanity. And that I can live a long and happy life, like my friend Edith did, and that my life will be one that's happy, joyous, and free. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. Now, I want to show you the real map of Michigan, okay? Now, you have to have kind of a broken little finger to really get the UP right up there. So, but anyway, the real map of Michigan is kind of more like this, and I live right there, okay? A little bit more about after I missed that first panel. I met a fella named Jalka. Now, and I don't know if Jalka's here. Jalka P. is from Finland. Now, my mother was born in Finland. She was born in Vasa, Finland. She was a Katajamäki. She's been dead for 11 years, but she did see me sober up, which was wonderful, because I know a couple of years before I sobered up, she was, and I wasn't an atheist or agnostic, I was a Lutheran and raised in a Lutheran church, but she would get on my case, and I one time, and I'm not proud of this, told her to stick her God right where the sun don't shine, all right? About a year after I was sober, I was having a discussion with my mother, the same mother. And I'm telling her all about God. And my mother says to me, son, I've been praying for you for years. I am glad you found AA, but please don't start telling me about God. But anyway, back to Jalka. Jalka didn't speak real good English. I don't know if Jalka's in this room, but he's on a panel, I noticed, this afternoon, the Finnish panel. And we were talking. And in the discussion, and you know, Jalka's about the same age, he's retired, I'm retired, and we started talking about the sauna. Not sauna, sauna, okay? Anyway, Jalka has a sauna at his home, and I have a sauna in my basement at my home, and you're, well, maybe not. I was going to say you're all welcome to come, but maybe not. Anyway. We got a little bit further, and we discovered that we both, when we drank, liked to drink beer in the sauna. You know, that gives you a little extra buzz, I'm telling you. And we also, when we were younger, would jump in the snow naked and make angels in the sauna. So there's just the one. I mean, I met, if I had been in that panel, I would not have met Jalka. But I did get to my second panel. It was the Grapevine Play. It was at 11:30, the Grapevine Play. However, I squeezed in the room. There was no security guys there. I found an empty chair over to the side. More and more people were trying to squeeze into that little room. And they announced that it wasn't really the play. The play, the next sessions after that, maybe some of you saw, were the Grapevine Play, but that first session was not the Grapevine Play. It was going to be what they called a grape balloon session, which is akin to a hot potato session or a Red Ball session. And many, many of you go to conferences and programs, and you've run into that kind of sessions. And there's a couple kind of people that go to them sessions. Some immediately out the door. Now, I'm not a big fan of them, but I learned as I came to believe over the years that when I sat down and I committed myself to go here, I am going to see it through. Something good is going to come out of this. I'm going to tell you what came out of this that was good. Okay, for me. There was a lady sitting next to me, and when they went to throw that grape-colored balloon, see, it would be your turn to talk for a couple of minutes, and this lady sitting next to me, and she would get her hands up. She wanted to talk. She had something to say. See? But I was like, another lady got up and talked, and I was like that, and I bet you're all kind of like this. I said, if they throw that great balloon to me, I got to be prepared to say something. So I'm thinking about what I'm going to say if I catch the great balloon, see? And finally I come up with something really good that I was going to say when I was going to catch that great balloon, and I whispered to the lady next to me, I said, if they ever throw you that balloon, you can give it to me next. Okay, I did. And she patted me on the arm and said, thank you, and all that. And anyway, the meeting proceeded, and the balloon was being tossed around the room, and people were getting up to share. She finally got the balloon. Okay? And she was going to pass it to me next. I was not watching the watch. She was going to pass it to me next, and the two people coordinating that panel, they grabbed the balloon. Time's up! So, God again was telling me something, you see. So. Now, I don't know how this leads on to Bob from New York, but anyway, our next speaker is Bob from New York.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Bob O, and I'm from New York. And I am an alcoholic, that you can bet on. And New York, where I'm from in Rockland, is this is great. This is really great. I am a little nervous, but I guess that's normal. You know, I never ever pictured that I'd be in front of a group this large speaking, especially about alcoholism. Because I wasn't an alcoholic, you know. At least I didn't think so. I was a heavy hitter and proud of it, you know. But most people around me didn't feel that way. But what they had to say didn't matter. Went in here, went out here, and I did what I wanted to do anyway. You know, and my life fell apart. Very slowly, but it fell apart. I'm originally from the Bronx, but I spent more time in Rockland County now than I did in the Bronx. And when I first meeting I went to, everybody seemed to say, I'm an Irish Catholic from the Bronx. I fit it, you know, so maybe I did belong. But I also know I'm not here because my father drank. I'm here because I drank. I know that when I got here, I wasn't going to stay here, you know. I hadn't come to believe that. I came to believe that if I dressed nice and looked nice, that I would feel nice. And that wasn't the case. You know, I was pretty good at looking outside, but not inside. And by the time I got to these rooms, I couldn't look in the mirror. And I thought about suicide every day. Never told anyone, but that's how I felt. And I was a beer drinker from the Bronx, you know. So I went to meetings, you know, where I got confronted, you know, and I admitted I was an alcoholic, and my uncle took me to a meeting on a Friday night in Pelham, and I had a six-pack first, you know, I mean, I wasn't drinking, you know, and I had my Benacca and my Visine, you know, and then I made sure by having some garlicky Chinese food, you know, this they'll never tell. And I went to this beginners meeting, and they said, everybody around, and I'm so-and-so, and then And, of course, I was in the back, you know, and when it got to me, I said, I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic, and I was on stage. You know, it's okay. All I know is it worked well enough for me. You know, I'm one of eight children, and I grew up in a home where alcohol I couldn't tell you my first drink. This big, doesn't matter. I could tell you my first drunk. But I, you know, it didn't matter. I saw alcohol as a release, an escape for a good time. And when I first picked up the drink, I went as a junior counselor up into Rockland, and I, you know, some of the kids were bigger than me, but when they went to bed, we went to Fatima Hall, we broke out the bud and put on the rock and roll music, and in a short time, I was Al Jolson and Fred Astaire combined, you know. And for you younger people, that's Elvis Presley and John Travolta. You know, and from that day on, man, I loved what it did for me. It took me out of myself, made me comfortable with the ladies, and I could be okay. And I graduated from high school, and I went into broadcasting, and that kind of fit the mode where I was on stage, because I knew how, you know. Worked in broadcasting and advertising. I went out to lunch the very first day, and the guy said to me, what are you going to have to drink? And I said, we got to go back to work. You know, it was my first day. He said, hey, you're in broadcasting. He said, okay. And I said, home run. And my problem was that my lunch hours got longer and longer and longer, till finally I went out to lunch and stayed out to lunch for 10 years. You know, I mean, that's about it. I mean, in the meantime, I was married, had a couple of kids, you know. And by the time I got to these rooms, my children were not talking to me. Well, one was, but two of them weren't, you know. And I wasn't welcome in my own home. But I wasn't going to leave, you know. My attitude was, don't let the door hit you on the way out, you know. It just, it's my house. And it really wasn't, you know. My family stood by me, thank God. And today I got to attend a couple of weddings, you know, as the father of the bride twice, and then my sons. And now I was meant to be a grandpa. I have five grandchildren, and it's great, you know, because they can go home, or I can go home, one or the other. But, you know, it took me a while to come to believe. I hated all the stuff I hated in AA, you know, I've come to love. I hated the expression KISS, keep it simple, stupid, because I wasn't stupid. You know, and that guy said, don't drink, go to meetings and listen to the pop. And I said, what pop? And he said, when your head pops out of your butt, you'll hear it. You know. How apropos, you know, and I used to say, but you don't understand, and if only, and he said, no, you don't understand, you know, and I hated the second step, because it said, came to believe, you know, that power greater than us would restore us to sanity, and I wasn't insane, crazy, but not insane. And then that's another thing, the alcohol allowed me to be crazy, I could do stuff, and justify it by saying it's the alcohol, you know. And it wasn't, it was me. And in sobriety, I got to work, much like Joe, in mental health, you know. I worked on a psych ward for a dozen years, where my job was to either talk you down or take you down, and it didn't matter which one to me very much, you know. Because the only difference between you and me was I had a key. You know. And that's pretty true, folks. You know, I found out I sobered up, and I am crazy, and it's okay. You know, at any rate, just a little bit. I don't want to go into war stories here, but my youngest daughter was 14 when I had like 2 years in the program, and she's now 30. So I'm seven. My sober date is February 88, and. You know, I came home from work one night a little late, and my wife, who was sitting in the audience, said, where were you? You know, and my youngest daughter said, I hate that. What are you doing? And we both looked like she had two heads. And she said, that's what you used to say to, Daddy when he came home late all the time. And I didn't realize that I affected anybody but me. And 90 days in the program, when I celebrated 90 days, my son gave me a hug on the front lawn and told me he was proud of me. This is a kid that wasn't talking to me. Anyway, back to my daughter, the 14-year-old, was in high school, and she said, or middle school, I forget which one, it doesn't matter, high school. She said, Dad, we have to write a poem, you know, to do with the subject. And I said, well, you know, she said, I want to write about AA. And I said, why don't you just get an old tag card, write my father's an alcoholic, and walk around the school with it, you know. You know. I mean, that's my sense of humor. So I said, we'll do, you know, something about a veteran or something. I don't know. Just whatever, you know. And I started it, and then I had to leave to go to my Monday night AA meeting, which is kind of like a marathon. It's, in those days, it was like 40, 50 guys there, and the meeting started at 8:30 and ended when the last person spoke. So and we still have that. It's still about 2 hours now, but it's, you know, it's not what it's still great. At any rate, I come home and sitting on the table near my chair is exactly what I had left her with, you know, which to me was always, Dad, I need help, you know. So I picked up, I shuffled the papers to get a clean piece of paper, and I saw this thing, and I just kind of rearranged it. I think I can maybe added a word or two, but it's dated. You'll tell by what it says, but it's a poem she wrote. Says the meeting. It says people in their seats, voices of despair, obstacles to be beat, smoke fills the air. How did it happen? Stories to be told. Listen attentively while their lives they unfold. They gather together with hope to be free. They lean on each other, for that is the key. Anonymous they remain, each battling to sustain sobriety, for that is their fame. So, she brought it to school. She brought it to school, and the people took it, and they had it published, and you know, so I'm kind of proud of that, as I should be as a dad, which I've learned to be. You know, in fact, I came to believe, I don't want to drag this out, I could forever, I have that Irish disease, you know, diarrhea of the mouth. At any rate, I hated KISS, and I hated Came to Believe because I wasn't, you know, but I found out lots of things. I found out that happiness was an inside job. It was not having what you want, but wanting what you have. And when I first got here, I didn't want anything that I had. And I didn't care. And they said, let us care for you till you care for yourself. Let us love you till you love yourself. Because we had a guy in my group, he said, my name is Jimmy L. I'm an alcoholic, and I love myself. And I used to say, and I'm the king as I am. You know, because I didn't like looking in the mirror, and I certainly didn't like Bob. But I do, I can look in the mirror today. Not bad for a 63-year-old, huh? At any rate, I found out that's what this program was about. And that was coming to believe. I came to believe that I needed the we in my life, that I couldn't do it alone. You know, and when I came to believe that, everything changed. It's like I wasn't going to stay in the program because I was going to prove you guys wrong. The big book says most alcoholics can't stay sober for a year. So I was going to do 366 days just in case it was a leap year. Not that I checked, you know. And then I would give everybody my Italian hello and leave. And I found out at a big book meeting about 10 minutes into the program when somebody else was reading the story about Dr. Addict Alcoholic, you know, and I'm not certainly not a professional man, and I never used drugs, probably because they weren't around, and they got to the point on page 449 in the third edition that says, I always thought I was a nice guy that drank too much, and the light went on. You know, it's always the night. I just drank too much. I was a nice guy. And it said the next line says, the best thing that happened to me was I was an alcoholic, and I didn't feel too good about that one. You know, it wasn't the best thing that night. You know, the next page, next line says, the best thing ever happened to me. And I can stand here today and tell you it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. Because I have a disease called alcoholism that wasn't, you know, and I'm going to die an alcoholic, but I don't have to die a drunk. I have a choice today. When I first got to these rooms, I didn't have a choice. I detoxed on my own because I was too important to take off of business, you know, for 30 days, you know. And that just shows you where my head was. And I had to listen for the pop. You know, so, but at any rate, I did one day at a time. I learned that, you know. And I only learned it when my sponsor said, Bob, did you drink in the same bar every day? And I said no, because I wasn't invited back a lot, you know. So he said, treat the meetings like you did the bars. Think of, plan what you're doing, you know, and get a place 7 nights a week that you can go that you're comfortable in case I'm not around. And so that's what I did. And I can tell you today after several 24s that I have a place to go every single night. And when I got the opportunity to speak, and I've never turned it down, and I got the opportunity to speak in the city, and I went there, and it was fun. And this program for me has been a fabulous journey, fun. And from that, I got a call, and I felt like I was nominated for the Academy Award. And of course, my ego gets in the way right away. You didn't notice, I guess, right? You know, because it's I can't believe all the humiliation I would go through to drink, and they said, be humble. I said, how do you do that? You know, because when you say you are, you're not. But I do know that it's a we program, and I had to come to believe. And that's what I did. I came to, and then I came to believe. And I never knew that I lived my life in fear. I could be a tough Marine from the Bronx, you know. I'll show you how much I knew about my life was that when drinking wasn't a problem yet, I had a tube that fit in my golf bag that held 6 beers. You could take them up one at a time. And Schaefer changed the size of their can, made it a little taller, thinner. You could only get 5 in it. So I switched to Bud. That's how important that beer was. Did I see that? No. So when I got here, man, I did not see that I had a problem, maybe. It was you. And my wife. And the mortgage. And the dog. You know what I mean? It wasn't me. God. Thank God it's self-inventory, right? And today, you know, but from day one, when I went to that men's meeting, first of strange things happened. The first meeting I went to, and I said, I'm Bob, and I'm dry for a day and a half, because I couldn't say alcoholic at that time. And I know God has a sense of humor because he sent this Hispanic guy in a leather jacket, black shirt, gold chains, a cowboy hat. Came up and gave me a hug, and I said, what the hell did I do now? Because I wasn't used to getting hugs from men. You know? And I found out it's okay, you know. I found out it's okay. And he led me to my men's group that I still go to, you know. And he showed me the way, how to be honest with myself. Because I was definitely a legend in my own life. You know, And today I'm comfortable in my own skin. If I can pass that off to anything. Today I did not have when I heard God in the rooms, I didn't want to hear it. They said, good orderly direction. I said, yeah, right. You can tell me. You know, a group of drunks, I didn't want to be part of that. And a lady sat up here one day and said, the gift of dignity. And I didn't have any, so I hung on to that. And I realize now, many years later, that it was a gift of desperation that got me to these rooms. Because if I wasn't desperate, I wouldn't be here. And today I'm not desperate, I am here. And today I have the we in my life that I talk about. I believe today that if I do the next right thing, I'll stay sober. Now last night, I don't know how much time I've used, but last night to me was, I got goosebumps. And I can feel today. I can cry. I found out that men do cry, you know. I don't have to be John Wayne, I just have to be Bob. you know. And last night when they sang Amazing Grace, I had goosebumps and I was a slow start because my voice was trembling, you know. And I woke up smiling this morning because last night I was dreaming and I have no reason for this, but I know I came to the program, I showed up, and I learned how to grow up, because I certainly was not a grown-up when I got here. And, you know, I've told you my age, so I didn't get here early. But I love kids, you know, and I'm able to be a grandpa, and I play with them, and I sing their songs. And last night I was in this room with a bunch of people, and I got up here, and I remember when I went downtown, there was a microphone. It was the first time I had used one, and I said, I can start singing, and we'll all be out of here in 10 seconds. And last night I was saying, you know what? How many people here still want to be a kid? Raise your hand. A lot, right? How many of you people know kids' songs? All right. So what I thought I would close with is inviting all of you to join me to a song that I was singing in my dreams, which was, if you're happy and you're sober, clap your hands. If you're happy and you're sober, clap your hands. If you're happy and it's sober and you really want to show it, happy and you're sober, clap your hands. And then we go to stop his feet and all that, but I know you'd want me to say, if you're happy and you're sober, say amen. Amen, people. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Bob. Let's give all three of these speakers a wonderful round of applause. Now that the standing ovation is over and we got a few extra minutes, I got a few things to say. I'm going to read a few lines out of the big book on page 49, the last few sentences. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought for ourselves. I want to thank you all for attending this panel. And we're going to close now. I have a choice of three things when we close as chairperson: the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer, or the Responsibility Pledge. Now, my home group and the Ishbing Hematite group closes with the Lord's Prayer. So those of you that may not like that, just respect those that do, because we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer.